Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you'd like to take that commitment a step further, truly commit, you know? You can help us grow this mission and this movement by reaching more people by becoming a subscriber. Sign up at patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. Coming up today, Democrats are absolutely prioritizing public safety in Olympia. The only problem is they're prioritizing the wrong bills. And by that, I mean the bills that really aren't going to do anything for anyone. Also coming up, do fifth graders need safe spaces in school where white kids aren't allowed? Of course they don't, but that does not stop a couple elementary schools, or at least one elementary school in Olympia, Washington, from creating such spaces. Also coming up later in the show, I want to address questions I've been getting from a lot of you, a lot of you, about my future career plans and a thought that I'm going to abandon you on the Undivided podcast, which is simply not the case. So I want to put a rest to those questions once and for all. So I'll address that at the end of the show. I would be remiss if I did not start the show with the news, the big news. Seattle and King County say that COVID-19 vaccines are no longer a condition of employment. And this is so interesting because this morning I was sent the news about Mayor Eric Adams in New York City saying that they were going to rescind their vaccine mandate. And really quickly, Seattle and King County followed suit. And I mean, yeah, I want to celebrate it because even though it is far, far too late, even though there shouldn't have been a vaccine mandate in the first place, I think this is positive. So we're going to celebrate that. Obviously, I'm troubled by the timing because nothing has changed from when this vaccine mandate went into effect in the fall of 2021. We knew in the fall of 2021 that vaccines did not prevent the spread of COVID, and they did not prevent people from getting COVID. So at that stage, I mean, August, September, and remember we talked to Ari Hoffman about how internal emails between health officials in our state acknowledge that no, vaccines aren't going to be our path out like we thought. Breakthrough cases are becoming far too common. And so when they moved forward with the vaccine mandate anyway, there was no basis for it. There was truly no basis for it except them feeling like they needed to protect people from themselves. Because to me, still the only lasting benefit of the vaccine, the only redeeming quality of the vaccine, was that there did seem to be data showing that you had a smaller risk of getting seriously ill or dying. It wasn't zero, but it was smaller. That's the only data that I've really seen kind of proven time and time again. So it was basically the government saying, oh, we're going to protect you from yourself, which is ridiculous. And then they put people out of work. So there's a few questions that this leaves for Seattle and King County. One of them is, what happens to the people who got fired? I mean, we had firefighters, we had police officers, we had metro workers, we had a lot of people. In the grand scheme of the number of city and county employees, was it a lot? No, it was like 3% total. But that's still people who were put out of work. So the mayor's office, and this is according to the Seattle Times, says 174 city employees were fired as a result of the mandate. They use the phrase separated. Yeah, they were fired, okay? And they can now apply for vacant positions at the city. So I don't know if that means, I think there's still, an SPD said this in a statement, there's a lot of questions about how they proceed. Because what if you were fired, your position is not there anymore? Do you get tenure when you come back? Is there back pay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So there are a lot of unanswered questions about that. But, you know, in their statement about why they're doing this now, the King County executive says, health officials tell us that there's enough immunity in the community. What, immunity from what? Are you now acknowledging natural immunity? Are you claiming that the vaccine gives you immunity? That doesn't make any sense. Neither of those things make sense. One, you never really acknowledge natural immunity in a significant way. Are you acknowledging it now? And then, you know, vaccines don't provide immunity. So, yeah, I mean, this is big. I think my natural question was, is the state going to follow suit, the state of Washington? And, you know, Governor Jay Inslee, he has been very steadfast that this is the right thing for the state. His spokesperson told the Seattle Times there's no plans to modify or remove the existing mandate for state employees. Does he stick to that? I don't know. I mean, he's just lost another sort of, I mean, I don't believe there's any remaining legitimate reasons to keep the state mandate. But now you have the most progressive city and county in the state that have decided, and they're claiming based on the science and what health officials are telling them, that you don't need this anymore. And so how can the governor justify it? Because like kind of his own party, his own people are saying we don't need it anymore. I don't know if he'll wait for old Gavin Newsom in California. I don't know what the current situation is in California, but it seems like we don't do anything until those states do something. But it's really a shame to hear and to read that in light of this, the state has no plans to lift its mandate, because that's just ridiculous. I mean, you now have people who agree with you politically who are saying there's no necessity for it. So it's positive news. Really happy to hear it. I don't know what the motivation is. It's got to be something, right? I tend to think they were waiting for enough daylight between when they first issued it and now to look like they're backing away from it for scientific reasons and to not like look like idiots. But there was no justification for it in the first place. They could have incentivized it from the onset. They should have just incentivized it from the onset. Instead, they let go of hardworking, dedicated public servants, police officers at a time of rising crime, firefighters at a time of record overdoses and calls that they need to go to. So it was ridiculous and really, truly shame on them for not reversing course sooner. The following segment is presented in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Let's head down to Olympia, where Democrats aren't willing to pass reasonable bipartisan bills to fix our state's broken police pursuit policy, which has led to thousands of criminals simply fleeing from law enforcement officers. They are, however, pushing other bills that they believe will improve public safety on our roadways and our waterways. Really, really important policies. And, you know, in reading these policies, I understand now why they're not prioritizing fixing police pursuits. For example, there is Senate Bill 5597, which aims to reduce the risk of accidents and fatalities among recreational operators of human-powered watercraft by establishing a new safety education program for human-powered watercraft. Now, what is a human-powered watercraft exactly? Well, according to this bill, a human-powered vessel includes, but is not limited to, canoes, kayaks, and stand-up paddle boards. So for those of you who might enjoy the occasional canoeing or kayaking or supping, as the kids call it these days, you might want to pay attention to this one. Senate Bill 5597, if it passes, would require you to obtain a paddle education card. A person shall provide a certificate of accomplishment issued by a boating educator for taking and passing a human-powered vessel safety education course, pass an equivalency exam, or provide proof of completion of a course that meets the standard adopted by the commission. Oh, and there's a $10 fee for the paddle education card, which will go to fund all commission activities related to the human-powered vessel safety education program. So Democrats might not be prioritizing fixing our failed police pursuit policy, but they are absolutely going to make sure that all you suppers out there are operating your craft safely. Another bill that proves Democrats really, truly do care about public safety is Senate Bill 5514, limiting when you can take a right on a red light. Senate Bill 5514 reads, a vehicle operator facing a steady circular red signal or red arrow at a controlled intersection may not proceed to make a right turn within 1,000 feet of the following facilities: a school, a child care center, a public park, a recreational center, a library, a public transit center, a hospital, a senior center, or any other facility with high levels of pedestrian traffic, which is essentially any intersection in the heart of any of our communities. But hey, this is about saving lives, right? This is about saving pedestrians' lives. This is absolutely about public safety. They take that very, very, very seriously, which is why Democrats have introduced Senate Bill 5383, which would give pedestrians permission to jaywalk anytime they'd like. So while Democrats are pushing to ban right on red to save pedestrians' lives, they are at the same time giving pedestrians carte blanche to cross the street even if they're not doing so in a crosswalk or at a light. One of the bill's key sponsors says, quote, while jaywalking laws may appear well-intended, they don't actually keep pedestrians safe and may instead put them at risk. National data shows that jaywalking laws are disproportionately enforced against Black people and in neighborhoods lacking infrastructure and resources. Our streets and right-of-ways need to have the safety of all users built into the infrastructure. Ah, yes, because you're so concerned about the safety of pedestrians that you won't let a vehicle take a right at a red light, but you will let pedestrians run across the street at any time they please, because that's certainly not going to be dangerous to them. No surprise, the Transportation Choices Coalition says it supports this proposal, saying jaywalking laws are outdated, unhelpful, and oppressive. These laws were written by the car manufacturers over 100 years ago to establish auto domination of the streets and don't keep people safe from traffic violence. Yes, I double-checked. That is actually a real quote. So lest you think that by not fixing the state's broken police pursuit policy, Democrats don't care about public safety, I would simply point you to some of these very, very important proposals, which are keeping us safe on the waterways by making sure that we pay extra money to take a course to use our paddles more safely, and by making sure that we can't take a right on red, which I guess is a pretty good idea if you're going to eliminate jaywalking as a crime. So there you have it, Democrats focusing on the public safety proposals that really matter. The previous segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. And can I just really quickly another aside about public safety and priorities? The King County Sheriff's Office came out with numbers today for how much its agency seized in drugs from that they seized last year alone. $17.5 million. $17.5 million. They say this is a huge, huge spike. They say that included 750,000 fentanyl pills, 30 pounds of powdered fentanyl, 465 pounds of meth, and more than 26 pounds of heroin. So fentanyl and meth, they are the two most common drugs that the King County Sheriff's Office is seizing. And this number is crazy for me. So when we're talking about fentanyl, which has been, you know, this huge driver in King County, fentanyl deaths are such a problem that the King County Medical Examiner says they're running out of room at the morgue for dead bodies and is specifically tying that to the number of people who are dying from fentanyl overdoses. And there was this number, so the Whatcom County, Washington Sheriff's Office posted this on Facebook a couple days ago. They said, and they put it in numbers, and this is what it really shows you how serious the problem is. The Whatcom County Gang and Drug Task Force says these are the numbers of fentanyl pills that it has seized starting with 2020 and up till 2022. In 2020, they seized about 20,000 pills. In 2021, they seized 143,000 pills. And in 2022, they seized more than 500,000 pills. So in just 2 years, from 20,000 fentanyl pills to more than 500,000 pills in that community. And that's not Seattle. Whatcom County isn't Seattle. It's not King County. So this is an issue that is across the entire state of Washington. And that's why I go back to when you have these, you know, rapid rise in drug overdoses and fentanyl in particular. So much so, like I said, the King County Medical Examiner says we're running out of room for bodies. And you've got politicians of all political stripes who will come out and say, oh, we have to stop the scourge of fentanyl. It's killing people on our streets, from the homeless to teenagers who think they're taking some designer pill and it ends up being laced with fentanyl. When I hear politicians say that, I immediately want to know, when I hear them feign concern over people dying of fentanyl overdoses, my immediate next question in my mind is, what are they saying about the southern border? Because if you claim to care about fentanyl overdoses, but you are not speaking out about the national security crisis we have at our southern border, if you're not speaking out about, hey, these drugs are coming into our community, what more can we do to stop them from getting in from Mexico in the first place? If you're not doing both, I don't want to hear from you. I don't want to hear you pretend to care about people dying on our streets, because you don't, because you're unwilling, incapable of acknowledging the source of the problem, which is Mexico. And there are things that can be done, you know, more funding for Border Patrol, not letting anybody and their mother through at the southern border who's claiming asylum, It's absurd to me. I haven't heard it from the governor. I haven't heard it from the attorney general. I haven't heard it from the King County executive. You know, we're a welcoming city for immigrants, which is fine. But we're also becoming a welcoming city for drug smuggling. And for the last big bust was the Mexican Sinaloa drug cartel. The bust itself, there was enough fentanyl to kill every person in King County. Now imagine how much wasn't discovered. Imagine how much wasn't found in that bust. So this problem is undeniable. It is filling up our morgues. It's killing our friends and our neighbors. It's killing people on the streets. And until Democratic leaders here are open and honest about the source of the issue, about what's happening at the southern border, then I will not, and I refuse to listen to a word they say about the drug crisis. You guys, I only got 12 pounds left to go. 12 pounds left to go to get back to my pre-COVID weight, which is so exciting and so doable. I'm going to New Zealand in March because I got drunk at some charity auction a couple years ago and bought my fiance a trip to New Zealand. But on the plus side, I'm not going to feel all fat because of my COVID weight. And I've been telling you guys about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I mean, truly, you know, I don't think I've ever said how I found out about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I listened to a radio show on my drive in the mornings, and one of their hosts was a sponsor for Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. And so I must have listened to them pitch it like 20 times before I'm like, you know, what do I have to lose? If I try it, you know, spend a little money on it, it doesn't work, fine. But I was feeling so gross for my COVID weight. I had just been to the doctor, got weighed, realized I gained 42 pounds, saw a picture of myself, realized that, yeah, I need to do something about this. And so after hearing it pitched over and over and over, I finally called and I ended up doing the program for 2 months before they even became a sponsor. And after I lost 25 pounds in those 2 months, I was like, absolutely, sign me up. I will pitch this to anyone who will listen. So if you just really need to get back on track and you want to do it quickly, do what I did, reach out to Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, schedule a consultation. You can do that at eastsideweightlossclinic.com or you can call them at 425-354-3020. You know, I posted a before and after picture on Facebook today and I had some people asking, hey, I don't live in Washington State. Do they have locations elsewhere? You don't have to live in Washington State. You don't have to live in the Kirkland area either where the clinic is because you can do the entire thing virtually. So it doesn't require any office visits. It just requires a commitment to eating healthier is a big one. It's not magic. I wouldn't try to pitch you on a program that's magic because you can't lose weight via magic. You are going to have to eat better. You're going to have to commit to it. But if you follow it, you can't not lose weight. And so I think that's a really important part of that is if you want a little structure to help you lose weight, to do it quickly, Eastside Weight Loss Clinic is a great plan for you. My friend Jason Rance over at 770 KTTH Radio in Seattle had this wild story over the weekend. I just had to have him on to discuss. You know, there's a lot of focus on schools right now in the culture wars. I think some of that focus is unfair, but a lot of it is fair. You know, I believe there's a lot of good teachers out there doing difficult work. They simply aren't getting enough credit for how hard it is to teach kids these days, especially with their shortened attention spans. But I do think that there is a lot of effort in schools to turn kids into activists and also to push this idea of, you know, identity over and over and over, that immutable characteristics such as your gender, your sexual orientation, the color of your skin dictate your success or failure in life or how other people treat you, which is the exact opposite of what we need to be teaching our children. And Jason Rance has been really good at digging out examples of this happening in our schools. The headline of an article he published over the weekend, "Elementary School Bans White Students from Safe Space Club." I'll let him explain the crux of the story. Jason Rance, welcome back to Undivided.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we're talking about fifth graders, right?
Mm-hmm. Eventually fourth graders, apparently.
Explain to people what you discovered.
Yeah, so I discovered that there is a racist club, effectively, or at least the policies around this club at Centennial Middle School in Olympia, where you basically have a principal who is defending a club that determines whether or not you're going to join its safe space on the basis of your race. And really by that, I mean no white people allowed. This is part of the sort of the movement of affinity groups where people who look the same or believe the same things get together and they exclude everybody else, which, again, it's 2023. It seems pretty hard to believe that we have to explain primarily to progressives that race-based admittance to clubs is probably wrong and that maybe we should encourage people to get together instead of be divided.
Is there any indication that at this elementary school, the rest of the school in general isn't a safe space for kids of color?
No. This is a school that, at least as far as I can tell, has not seen any controversies over racial elements within the, or racist elements within the school or on campus. The teachers are, I'm presuming, teach everyone equally. The funny thing is, when you think about it from this perspective, it makes even less sense. Kids will gravitate towards other kids, regardless of skin color, maybe not regardless of gender early on, because girls have cooties and boys have cooties, but at some point they start to hang out together naturally. And we're telling them something they want to do naturally, which is hang out with other people they find interesting, is now wrong and they shouldn't do that. And we are reinforcing this belief that you should feel uncomfortable around people who don't necessarily look like you, and the people you'll feel most comfortable around look like you. That is just the wrong message. It is a racist message.
Yeah, and that somehow you're not safe amongst white students or other students outside of this little group that you've formed. What has the pushback been like, and what's the school's response?
The parents have said that this is wrong. They don't want their kids to be taught this. And the school's response is nothing. They've given me no statement other than to confirm that the email that I excerpted in my KTTH.com piece is legitimate. And they said they were going to give me a comment. They didn't. I pushed my story 4 full days trying to get some because I wanted to hear from the district, because on the surface, this is illegal. Olympia School District has a non-discrimination policy that strictly prohibits this exact kind of thing. And on top of that, it's also just against the law. And I talked to an attorney, Mark Lamb, who's featured in my piece at KTTH.com, bringing out, just sort of breaking down why what they're doing is illegal for the people who think that this kind of racist membership is somehow okay.
I guess I wonder, because it clearly it's illegal, right? And so I wonder why we see so many instances of things like this in school, though. Do they think, like, parents will not push back because it's about race?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they believe. No one's going to sue over this. That's just the reality. And they know that. And even if they did, they would just justify it, because this is all being pushed in the name of equity and Black Lives Matter. Remember, we're right in the middle now of Black Lives Matter Action Week at school, or whatever it's called. And their whole point is to be really hyper-focused on Black students. And they think that this benefits them. I don't think that. I think most people probably look at this as divisive and quite the opposite of what we'd like to see happen in our schools and just in our society. But they believe, and it's mostly white educators who push this, they think that this is okay.
And you have this email from the school principal. I assume the email is in response to concerns over this particular group. And as a way to kind of defend it, she says, "We are exploring the possibility and interest in adding a student ally club, as a few students are interested." Does she mean like a club of
it's
like
for white people who want to virtue signal their support for Black people? But as I point out in my piece, if you want to have an ally club, that means those folks, it's safe for them to join your safe space. So again, it doesn't quite make sense to me that you're simply denying access. And I know folks on the left think that this is an unfair comparison, but it's not. If this was a whites-only club, wouldn't everyone reasonably be outraged? I know you would. I would be. We would call it out. We would say that's racist. And yet, because it's a quote-unquote marginalized community in a state that has focused exclusively on quote-unquote marginalized communities to the point where they're no longer marginalized by any stretch of the imagination, and frankly haven't been for decades, they think that somehow it's okay there. And again, I'm saying it's not. If it was a Christian-only club, if it was a male-only club, and they didn't let a transgender male in, there would be a huge uproar. But for some reason, folks on the left think that this is appropriate, and not a single one of them can defend it outside of the lazy argument that, well, they're fighting with white supremacy in the culture, and this is a way for them to truly be who they are. That is bogus nonsense. And if you truly believe that about any school, then as an administrator, you should be fired, because you are then in charge of creating this white supremacist culture, and you would be a racist. You should leave.
Yeah, you're raising these kids to believe that there is white supremacy, you know, in their, and this is the other thing that gets me, Jason. What do you, you know, we're talking like fourth graders, fifth graders. How old are fourth and fifth graders? Like nine, right? Something like that?
Yeah, 8, 9, 10 in that range.
Yeah, and this principal's email, it says, for these students, this space allows them to hang out, check in, and possibly talk about their experiences as a student in the minority as they build community connections and confidence. Like, what sort of real deep racial conversations are eight-year-olds going to have?
None. They're having none. Unless, of course, you've got an adult who is overseeing the club and is trying to push this nonsense on them. That's the only thing that could potentially come out of this, which is even more dangerous, or at least as dangerous as this kind of club.
What do you think it's going to take? You know, as you said, if you take some of these equity initiatives and you just replace BIPOC with white, everybody would be up in arms about it, as they should. But when it comes to issues of race, and when racism is brought into the conversation, you have this real hands-off approach from the mainstream media, from a lot of Democrats. What do you think it's going to take to turn the tide on that, so that when there's a story like this, it's not just someone like you on conservative radio pointing to it saying this is wrong?
Yeah, so I think two things. Number one, and again, I don't think it's going to happen, but I wish someone would sue. I wish there was a family that would step up and actually sue. I understand why they don't want to. Not only is it costly, you're going to get bullied and labeled a racist if you do. But unless the courts get involved, they're going to continue to allow for this. Number two, really what this is going to take are Black Washingtonians stepping up and saying, no, this is condescending. This is actually racist. We don't only feel comfortable around people who look like us the same way we hope that white people don't feel comfortable only around other white people or Asians, but around Asians. They are going to have to step up, because it's being done in their name. And I truly don't believe that the average Black Washingtonian or Latino or Asian or whomever actually supports this kind of nonsense. I think that they want to be treated just like everybody else, which, again, I thought we fought for decades to get to that point, only to then have it put in reverse by a bunch of woke white educators.
Yeah, because things went too far. I mean, I do think that there are some members of, you know, the Black community who do support these things. I mean, because Olympia...
Yeah, but I think it's a small group.
Oh, agreed.
A small group of loud activists who have the ears of a small group of white lawmakers and educators who have power.
Yeah, because I'll end on this. There has been other issues. There have been other issues in this particular school district. Wasn't the Olympia school district the one who put the woman on the school board?
Tawana Reed.
Yeah, who said, you know, can you give a little background on Tawana Reed? Because that just popped into my head.
Yeah, Tawana Reed is a BLM extremist. She is someone who has been openly racist towards white people. There's been a considerable amount of pushback from the community saying that she is not a reflection of this community. She doesn't hold the values that all of us hold, not because she's a Democrat, but because she's an extremist who has also pushed some pretty vicious conspiratorial positions on policing. And she's just not a good fit. That's what the controversy has been.
Yeah, and there was a video of her at the Capitol where she was speaking, and there was cops nearby, and she basically was saying, they don't listen to us until we like break shit or burn shit down or something like that.
Yeah, she was promoting rioting at the time.
Yeah, so it's like you got it at the top of the school district, you got it in elementary school classrooms, and you just have to ask yourself, like you said, parents of any race with kids of any race, is this what we want to teach our kids, that they need a safe place for people of their own race, that they should be scared of people of the other race, or that the people of the other race are somehow unsafe or make them unsafe? Jason Rantz, good stuff as always. I feel like you get so many of these little tidbits. I don't know if they're coming from parents, but I get the sense that there's a lot of parents who are fed up with this narrative.
Based on the emails I get, I would concur.
Yeah. Jason Rantz, host of The Jason Rantz Show on 770 KTTH in Seattle from 3 to 7 p.m. Frequent guest on Fox News. We appreciate you making time for us.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
And I think that last point of that conversation with Jason is so important about we have to somehow push past this. We have to push past this idea that basically segregating kids on the basis of race is so far removed from where we need to be and where we've come as a society. There's this constant effort to take us backwards, to go in the opposite direction of progress. And it is going to take progressives, liberal Democrats, people of color to step forward and say, hey, stop doing this. I don't want my kid put in some group based off the color of their skin. I didn't want that for me when I was in school. My parents didn't want that for themselves when they were in school. Why would I want my kid to be in a group that is specifically segregated to exclude someone of a particular race? That's so backwards. And I know, and I talked about this in a speech last week, I think that there is this real hesitancy, particularly among white people, but I would think among a lot of Democrats, to speak out when the issue is being centered around racism. Because they're scared of being called racist. They're scared of pushback. They're scared of being attacked. And race is such a sensitive issue. And I get that. And, you know, I've been called racist a million times for pushing back against some of these things. And you just have to get to a point where you don't care because you know it's right. And you know that stuff like this is wrong. I mean, come on, we're talking about fourth and fifth graders. We're going to instill in them at the age of 8, 9, 10 that there are substantial differences between them and their friend who's white, that they need to somehow be protected from their friend who's white. They need a safe space to be able to go to at school. I thought school was supposed to be a safe place in and of itself, but no, you have to have a safe space within a safe space that is segregated on the basis of race. This stuff is ridiculous, guys. So especially for Democrats, you have to speak out about this. You have to reject it. Identitarianism is a poison in our society, and so is convincing kids that they're problematized, that, you know, if you're not white and straight, then there's something wrong with you that society needs to help protect you in some way or lift you up in some way. It is so detrimental. This, I think, is one of the single most important conversations we need to have in our country, is this obsession with identity and being able to push past it, move on from it, and restore common sense to some of these conversations. All right, I want to have a little conversation with you guys. I have been getting endless emails, endless comments, asking whether I am going to take over the 12 to 3 spot on Kyra Radio. As you know, for 27 years, that time slot was hosted by my friend Dori Monson, who passed away on New Year's Eve. We had a memorial for him over the weekend, and I've been filling in. You know, I was filling in for Dory the 2 weeks before he died because he was just on vacation for the holidays. And then I agreed, you know, I used to work at Kyra Radio, and so I agreed to help him out, to fill in for a few weeks. And ultimately, I'm going to fill in through the end of this month. And so, you know, that's kind of what I've agreed to with them. And I know that they are conducting a search for that spot. And a lot of you have asked me if I'll take it, if I'm planning to take it, or if I want it. The answer is no. And I want to be super clear about that. This podcast that we're doing here, Undivided, is more than just, you know, a replacement for what I was doing on TV. I quit TV to do this. I quit a pretty well-paying job in television news to do the Undivided podcast specifically. And there was a reason for that. You know, I believe in the mission of this show. I think that we have to have a platform that is for people in the middle and people on the left and right who want to return to reason and common sense. And that's what I've built this show to do. So I am 100% committed to growing it. We have expansion plans coming up in the next few months based on feedback I got from all of you guys who took a survey I sent out. And, you know, would if they offered me the Kyra job, I'm sure it would be a great paycheck. But if this were about money, I wouldn't have left TV. You know, at the time before, you know, I really even had thought, it was even on my radar, that I might leave my TV job. I was talking to my agent about maybe looking for a job at one of the TV networks and growing my career that way. And, you know, the earning potential there is great. And I still decided to quit. So it's not about money. It's about what we're doing and the value that I see in what we're doing for the state I love, for the communities I love, for the people I love. and for society. You know, I wish there would be a podcast with the same mission in every state across the country that could supplement or be a counterpoint to some of the prevailing narrative in the press. And in Seattle in particular, you know, the local press has really been for far too long hook, line, and sinker with everything Democrats are doing. You'll see pushback pieces here and there, but they don't get a lot of traction. And so, no, you know, I just want to be really clear about that. I am not going to take that job. And it hasn't even been offered to me, by the way, but it's, you know, I've been very clear from the beginning that I'm just filling in through the end of February. I've had a great time doing it. It's been very, you know, kind of healing for me too, to be able to go in and speak to Dory's audience, who I love every single day. And I've really enjoyed doing it. And I've enjoyed getting comments from all of you and it, you know, reminders of things you loved about Dory's show, et cetera. So I've enjoyed doing it. I've been happy to do it, but it's not something that I'm going to do full time or a job that I'm interested in. So because I've been getting so many questions, I just want to set the record 100% straight. Undivided is where my heart is. It's where my head is. And it's where my future plans are. And I appreciate those of you who have joined me on this mission to say, hey, I believe in that, in the podcast and what we're trying to push there too. And I'm going to hop on. I'm going to support you. I'm going to subscribe. And so I'm excited for the things that are ahead. I'm sorry if that's disappointing news to anyone, but I am sure that Kyra Radio is looking for someone who can fill that role and be a watchdog of government and who can give people who've been listening to that time slot for 25 plus years, something to look forward to on the radio every day. Okay, on our show yesterday, which we did yesterday because I got locked out of my studio on Friday, which was a wild experience, but look, I'm back in, okay? So instead of Fun Friday, we aired the episode on Sunday. And I had a great, great sit down with my friend Jonathan Cho, and an independent journalist, used to work for Como TV News in Seattle, got fired over a video he posted covering a Proud Boys rally, ended up becoming a senior fellow and journalist for Discovery Institute, which is a conservative think tank. But he's doing coverage specifically around the issue of homelessness and substance abuse, et cetera. And he's been doing great work, I mean, by any journalistic standard. But the crux of the interview centered around a story I published last week that showed the lengths that some Democrats in Washington state were going to try to sideline Jonathan Cho from reporting on issues because of his affiliation with a think tank. And here's just a little clip in case you didn't catch the Sunday episode, although I highly recommend you go back and watch the interview with Jonathan Cho.
This, you know, opportunity, the media fellowship at Discovery Institute has really been really a blessing in disguise, right? Because in many ways, it's allowed me to really go after these stories that I've always wanted to go after more in depth now. In other words, I've been unleashed. Mm-hmm. I don't have the corporate restraints. I don't have the brand safe restraints. And I can just show, again, the raw realities on the ground. So, you know, I love what I'm doing.
You are working for a think tank, Discovery Institute, but sure. You're a senior fellow for fixhomelessness.org. Do you feel restrained in a different kind of way because of who you work for?
Well, let me just qualify all of that by saying, yes, I knew what I was getting myself into, quote unquote, the realities of working for or being associated with a conservative think tank. But I made it very clear when they offered me this media fellowship for 1 year, again, that I would have full autonomy, that I would be able to chase all of these stories objectively, fairly, and accurately without any agenda. So when I got the green light to do that, I said, I'm all in.
Yeah.
So I want to be very clear about that. I understand, you know, guilt by association, and my critics will always come up with something. But I'm a journalist through and through, 20 plus years in this business and television news, working for all the network affiliates in multiple top 10 media markets like Chicago, Minneapolis, my hometown of Boston, and now Seattle. So I have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm just going to continue to be a journalist. That's part of who I am, and it's my calling.
All right, I wanted to read some of your comments about our conversation. Aaron on Patreon wrote, I agree that if someone is being paid or that it's their full-time job, they are a journalist. Government definitely doesn't get to decide who is a journalist. Someone needs to remind them. Bill said, loved the interview with Mr. Cho. It was really nice to have him in, right? We've had him on via Zoom. It's just not the same. I love this new setup we have to be able to have people live in studio. You can have a much better conversation. Let's see here. E wrote, great interview with Jonathan. I still say all of you, you, Jonathan, Ari Hoffman, Jason Rance, Andy No, should get together, pool the resources, and create a new broadcast media like Piers Morgan did with Uncensored and made Talk TV, all independents that were disillusioned by BBC and Parliament correspondents that came together. Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting concept, or at least do something together monthly, for instance, like a roundtable. Jonathan has talked about that a little bit, having some sort of public access show that has journalists who are willing to have sort of the tough conversations. And I don't mean journalists all of one political stripe, but I mean, you know, journalists who are really willing to think critically and independently about the issues and aren't sort of, like I said, just a rubber stamp for the current party in power. Steve Larson said, thank you, Brandy and Jonathan, on all you do. Great work. Let's see. Renee said, I get a tickly feeling knowing that your stories are read and monitored by the very people you're talking about. If you're not pissing someone off with the truth, you're not doing it right. Keep on the good fight. And she says, P.S. Dow and Chase, Dow Constantine and his press handler, Chase Gallagher. Guess what? Jonathan is a true journalist. One more. Mama of Six Rocks. You know, I should really ask you about that username. Do you have six rocks that you treat as children, or I don't know. She said, also so proud of you, Brandy and Jonathan, for standing up to corporate media and elected officials who ignore the rest of us. We need your voices so much. Keep up the great work. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, and I think that it's critical to support outlets who are doing the kind of journalism that you expect. You know, Jonathan Cho, he's funded through Discovery Institute, but I think when you watch his stories, I don't see how any reasonable or rational person could watch one of his stories and think, oh, there's bias there. They're very factual. And I also like that there's limited editing when it comes to a lot of moments. You know, for instance, I talked to him about getting chased down by a homeless man with an axe. And he posted that entire video, like beginning him running to end. It wasn't some weird little chopped part story that you might see on the Evening News that's 45 seconds. You really get much more of a vibe and a grasp on what's happening. And I also think that's a very important thing for media trust. The less editing you can do, the better. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to supporting independent journalism, to helping to spread this mission and this movement to give common sense a comeback. If you want to join for as little as $5 a month, I would sure appreciate it. Patreon.com/undivided. Or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Don't forget, we do a bonus episode just like this every Wednesday for subscribers. So for you subscribers, I will see you then.